the Flyers again in the red zone. Absolutely lethal.
Full extension.
1v2, it doesn't matter for Holzmeier. That is a grown man move.
Jacob Fairfax.
What a huge layout catch block. Oh my goodness. Oh! Hayden, Austin, Knapp.
Burnett racing back and will do the hustle.
Anything you can do, I can do better.
Welcome back. It's Swing Pass. I'm Adam Ruffner. That is Cameron Brock. I have to apologize really quickly. I've been experiencing some internet latency issues. I am downloading so many terabytes and uploading so many terabytes of video in the background in the middle of these days that when we have time to record, it's not always at optimal internet usage for me, so I apologize for the lack of being able to be seen lately. I'm hopefully having an internet technician come out, get me a little bit more juice going through here, but we've got way too much to talk about for me to get all sidetracked into those details. Cam, we've got 10 games coming up in this Week 3 preview pod, and on the center stage is the game of the week, a rematch from week one between Atlanta coming off of a franchise-defining win against New York, traveling again to Carolina to face a Flyers team that beat the Hustle by 8 back in week one. This is going to be a little bit different of a matchup, though, given the absences on both teams, which I think is kind of where I want to start. For Atlanta, they're going to be without all UFA member Brett Holzmeier, all defense member Justin Burnett, two of the most instrumental parts of that big win against the Empire last weekend, not available in week three. Also missing Jakeem Polk, Adam Miller, who has been 9-0 with the team in limited usage between 2024 and 2021. He's 2-0 against New York, kind of their lucky monkey paw, I guess. He'll be absent, as well as Mike Kobira, who's been a really big part of that Hustle defensive pressures in one-on-one matchups. Then you flip over to Carolina, they're going to be down Saul Yannick, Henry Fisher, Ethan Bloodworth, Alan Laviolette, who looked amazing against the Hustle in week one in his return after two seasons off with an injury, as well as Ben Snell, who's just been solid as a rock whenever he's been available for this franchise the last several years. So there's going to be a lot of questions, I think, for both rosters as far as who's going to step up into those starting roles and produce in this big rivalry game that we'll get to in a moment is uber important for both these teams given the next three matchups that they face getting into the thick of their schedules. But I wanted to bring you in here. What are you most looking forward to in this game of the week matchup between Atlanta and Carolina on Saturday night?
So the most exciting thing in this matchup, I think, for me is just that both teams are going to be missing people, whereas last time, I think it really felt like going into the matchup that we knew Atlanta was without some key pieces, and it kind of felt like a rock fight where one side had more rocks than the other. It just wasn't quite fair. So I am excited to see maybe something that feels a little more even. That being said, it feels to me like looking at the absences, Atlanta is just going to feel the impact of these more with you already said it, how instrumental Brett Holzmeier and Justin Burnett were in that win. Jakeem Polk was great in coverage and also, you know, had arguably the play of the game, even though the play didn't even really count, just like jumping into the stratosphere. And he also, I believe, was the one who caught the first break score for them too. Which
he did,
got, you know, for that, that OI flick kind of right in the, he didn't even realize he was in. It was like so frantic. And then he was like, oh wait, I scored. So I think those are big absences, especially taking away two of their most dynamic players on defense, and then who has been their best probably player overall and definitely their biggest weapon offensively in Brett Holzmeier. It does feel a little bit more like those absences will be noticed on the Atlanta side. But Laviolette was, you know, had his fingerprints all over that 8-goal win a couple weeks ago.
Ethan Bloodworth too.
Yeah, so like you take those two out, maybe that does level the playing field a bit.
Yeah, no, I think that there's going to be a lot of leveling in this game, and like I say, it's both going to be an adjustment rematch as well as a calibrating game for both teams as they get into their next three matchups, which is kind of where I want to take us next. This will be the second of four meetings for Atlanta and Carolina this season. They also had four meetings last year. We've mentioned it before. Atlanta won 3-1 in their 2023 season series. But with Carolina getting the first game in this year's set of games, it's now 3-2 Atlanta in the last five games. Flyers can even that up. And then both teams going forward just have kind of a brutal next set. For Atlanta, they face yours truly, Indianapolis in their next matchup. Then they're at Colorado in a super series game against a very good-looking Summit squad. And then they host Austin in the first time Atlanta faces the Soul since the Soul came in to Atlanta last summer and upset the Hustle in that dramatic South Division championship game. So this is really important for both teams. I mean, I know we kind of stress that every single week. It's a very different format, I think, from what a lot of Ultimate players in particular are used to, the week-to-week standings sort of results base, as opposed to like tournaments and brackets. And so with Atlanta being 1-1 and Carolina 1-0, neither of them can really afford to drop these games given how hard their schedules increasingly get into the thick of this summer.
Yeah, and like on top of that, I mean, if there's like a silver lining for Atlanta, like they're missing some people that you would really, of course, like to see that they have. If they drop this game, that means they've dropped, I believe, the two road games in Carolina, right? They would still have two home games. But yeah, Atlanta's got kind of a brutal schedule. I mean, they already got past one of the games that were they probably had highlighted on their schedule as like a tough game out of division, beating New York. But going to Indy, going to Colorado, those are playoff teams from a year ago. Colorado looked great in week one. Be curious to see how, you know, they look until on the way to Atlanta going out there. I expect Colorado to look like a top three or four team all year. But yeah, this game could be really important because also keep in mind that right now Atlanta is 1-1, but they're 0-1 in the division. And when it comes to tiebreakers at the end, it's not just your head-to-head tiebreaker, but that division record comes into play too. And I believe they have more of these out-of-division games on their schedule than Carolina does, which means that for every division game they lose, they don't have as many opportunities to kind of make those wins back up later in the schedule. So that really could come into play later. Obviously, you want to be winning the head-to-head matchups. I think this is going to be one of those games where both teams are going to have to find ways to grit things out because they're going to have some maybe unnatural lineups out there or some groups of guys working together that aren't necessarily in the game plan to be working together all the time. So it might be a bit of patchwork on both for both teams. I will be really interested to see who Atlanta goes with to kind of fill that Brett Holzmaier role because they don't have a Brett Holzmaier-esque player on their roster like to replace him with. It's not like...
Let's get into it a bit. I'll push back a little bit there. Okay. I think Dean Ramsey has been a little bit of their big target fill-in. He's had some good games against the Flyers. They have other things to fill. I hear what you're saying. I think what it comes down to for me is how that Atlanta offense deals with Carolina's mid-game defensive adjustments. Because that's where the Flyers really separated in week one. Remember, going up early in that game, the Hustle were up 4-2, I think. And then Carolina started to disconnect the backfield play of Hustlers, Handlers, Bobby Lay and Austin Taylor from what was going on downfield. And so you'd look at the box score and you'd see this monster game from Hayden Austin Nabb and Brett Holzmaier and you'd think, oh, Atlanta must have punched pretty well. But that wasn't how the game film revealed that matchup at all. It was Carolina just sort of taking apart the Hustle offense limb from limb and figuring out exactly where they could apply pressure while kind of letting Holzmaier fill up on empty calories in what was otherwise an 8-goal blowout win for the Flyers. And so I think that, you know, what it comes down to for Atlanta is what do they do by the end of like quarter one and especially building into quarter two when Carolina is so good at these sort of figuring out and getting data at the beginning of a game, readjusting and just clamping down and making you work through kind of your weakest areas, which was something that I think surprised us as far as the week one result of Atlanta just didn't really have that. They didn't have that kind of discipline that carried them so much last season. And what we saw last weekend against New York, where they'd have so many good, like, settle-down drives, as I like to call them, where they just sort of weave, get a lot of Christian Olsen and Matt Smith action, and then sort of balance that out with obvious deep shots that this Hustle team loves.
Yeah, I don't know. I am nervous for Atlanta. I'm nervous for what their offense is going to look like, because the other part of it wasn't just like the struggles they had in, you know, moving the disc. It was the struggles they had in getting the disc back. What Carolina converted on 85%, if memory serves, of or somewhere in the neighborhood of their break chances that they had. So their D line conversion percentage was off the charts. That was
well,
really
and I think that. To your point there, I think that's where they're going to miss Halsmeier for Atlanta. Mm-hmm. You know, they basically have an all-defense player playing in transition should they make a mistake when he's in the lineup. And Dean Ramsey is a very capable defender, I think, in one-on-one matchups deep, but he doesn't have the kind of foot speed and pressuring instincts, I think, that Halsmeier does to make him a weapon basically wherever you line him up. And I hear you there. That Carolina break percentage in the first week was incredible.
Yeah.
83%.
Yeah. Now they are without Fisher and Yannick, who were kind of championing that to some extent as well. So I would, and Laviolette, like, who I think was on for some of that, but Bloodworth's gone. Maybe that conversion percentage probably isn't going to be touched based on the absences that they have on their D line this week for Carolina. But still, it was a little concerning to me. We've seen that in both games, New York had trouble converting break chances. So them keeping New York from converting break chances wasn't, I guess, as surprising when you also take into account what happened in the Montreal game. But in the Carolina game, I mean, it just looked, they also had a lot of turns close to their end zone, which I guess, you know, you turn the disc within 10 to 15 yards of your end zone, it's going to be hard to get the disc back. So there's elements of that as well. If they can find some success in that mid and short game, so they can at least move the disc a little bit down the field before they turn it, that certainly is going to help things and give them more of an opportunity to get to earn that disc back. I am just really worried without somebody who has just been so integral to everything they've done on offense over the last year plus in Brett Holzmeier, without two guys on defense who are two of your, hey, go get a D guys. That makes me really nervous. Whereas I feel like Carolina is going to be a little bit better able to absorb the absences that they have and push through them. And honestly, it's something that they're kind of used to doing as their roster last year, they had to kind of deal with that. And even in the past, like they occasionally deal with these people coming in and out, where I feel like Atlanta, so much of their success last year and even in other seasons has been when they've been able to keep the core together for the whole season. So I'm expecting to see a better effort than we did in week one. I don't think we're going to see an 8-goal blowout, but I do still favor Carolina in this game.
Two players I want to highlight on both offenses for Atlanta, the kind of, I think, very well-known and expected emergence of Haden Austin-Knabb. Now that he's finally getting a full-time role on offense, the results are starting to speak for themselves. He's 58-60 in his first two games. On throwing attempts, he's got 8 total scores, 2 assists, 6 goals, and is averaging above 350 yards per game. That's kind of, I think, where we saw his prospect the last several seasons. He just hasn't really gotten much of a crack into the starting rotation of this offense, but I think you're starting to see that now, and it'll be interesting to see how much higher his ceiling goes as he just gets more and more confidence in this very structured and, I think, elevating Atlanta offense. I think this Atlanta offense has a real opportunity to enshrine a player of Austin Knabb's talents. And then the guy we kind of talked about as being an X factor last week against New York, Jeremy Langdon, he was not available in week one against Carolina. He figures to just be another tough piece in this hustle offensive rotation. And I think that he could find a lot of success against what Carolina often likes to do and kind of quote unquote, their down lineup matchups, which is throw a lot of youth and fresh legs and guys who kind of like to lay out at you. That was really successful, I think, in week one against Atlanta when they were down a few of these more stabilizing offensive pieces. I don't know if that works as well against a player like a Jeremy Langdon or even a Matt Smith, who are just so much more disciplined to kind of taking those punches as they come and still coming right back at you with a lot of production. So I think they could be big, big pieces. And then figures every single time these two face off, Jacob Fairfax for Carolina. He's just somebody who I want to see him have like a 40 touch game just to see what he's capable of, but he just stays so consistently between 15 and 20. And he's so efficient at that level that it's hard to really say that you want more from him, but he continues to be just, I think, one of the most impressive season in, season out offensive players in this league. And he always seems to step up in these rivalry matchups. In addition to him, Anders Jungst, he's just somebody who I think, given the injury he sustained in his second season and given the underperformance of the Flyers last year, I think he came into the season a little discredited in this league or a little under talked about. I mean, he's a world's roster participant. And as you saw in week one against Atlanta, there just wasn't really anybody who matched up well with him. He kind of just got to his spots. And I expect very similar things this week without a Justin Burnett or a Jakeem Polk or even an Adam Miller or a Kobira, all four of whom kind of figure to be matchup potentials for Jungst in his acceleration and burst. So yeah, I just think given those defensive absences, there's going to be some tough outs that Atlanta has to face in this Flyers offense. Like, again, the Flyers, I think, still have looked to this point like the best team of 2024. Like, they look the most polished coming into this season. But, you know, Atlanta's coming off of this absolute monkey off their back in addition to historic win against an opponent they've been gunning for since they got theirs back in 2021 against the Empire. So we know how Atlanta feeds off of big games. I wanted to pivot to another big one this weekend. It's on Friday nights. It's Boston at DC. These two teams met three times last season. DC claimed all three, including a first round seven goal over the Glory. Boston enters this game though 2-0. They look completely revamped, having signed the reigning MVP Jeff Babbitt, as we've talked extensively on this show. And DC is coming off of their first win of the season. They're 1-1 now, having fallen that first weekend in Salt Lake in the first Super Series matchup. Both these teams now competing for the right to first place in the East Division, and it not being New York by this point in the year for the first time in I don't know how long. I think since like 2018 is like the last time by this point in the season New York wasn't one or two in the East Division standings. So this is a big game for both teams. Boston's going to be down some pretty notable defenders in Ivan Tran, Phil Joyce, Ryan Cable, not a defender. He made his big 2024 debut this past weekend. He will be unavailable, but another defender Glory will be missing is Chris Bartoli. Mm-hmm. DC gets David Bloodgood back for his first game of 2024. Hats off to him. He just passed his dissertation. Big congratulations there. But the Breeze defense will be without Jasper Thom. He's still got some kind of nagging injury, hasn't made his 2024 debut. So going into this matchup, Cam, what are you looking at for these two teams?
Well, I mean, I hate to go with the obvious here, but like Jeff Babbitt was an absolute monster in those games last year at DC. We have a game that we kind of refer to as the Jeff Babbitt game. Jeff Babbitt owns the front cone, you know, just seeing him back in DC with a new team. I'm excited to see what he looks like. He's looked great so far. He's looked exactly like what we expected him to look like. Didn't have to do too much in their game last week against Toronto as they kind of started taking off on that one early. But I did like seeing Orion Cable out there with him last week. Like, it just kind of seems like a matchup nightmare to have to worry about both of those guys. And then, you know, you just have Carapella just running around. Last week, I think he actually ended up, was it through twice as many assists in a game as he ever had before? I think he just...
A lot of them were red zone attempts, to be fair. I would encourage Evan Lepley to go look at some of those.
Sure.
But he did throw a lot of hucks. He showed some range that he doesn't normally show.
Yeah, and that was kind of get to. They weren't necessarily the assists, but he did start to show a little bit more throwing that I don't feel like we saw from him last year. But it's also like really easy. Yeah, when you have Orion Cable and when you have the disc in the red zone and you have Orion Cable and Jeff Babbitt on your team, it kind of feels like the next throw probably is going to be a score to one of those guys.
There are some trust balls going up in Boston, and it isn't necessarily the worst decision. I'm remembering one of the last scores for Glory this last week was Carapella just putting a hanger up to Cable in double coverage, and of course Orion just absolutely dominating everyone in his vicinity. But I think for me, this matchup comes down to Is Jeff Babbitt going to be on defense for this game, kind of in his first, I think, full-time defensive role for Glory? Because that's where they most needed it against the Breeze. This Boston defense, for all of their, I think, ability to pressure other squads for their really good matchup potential in one-on-one situations, they do not fare well against this Breeze offensive system. They just really struggle to dispossess them of the disc and really affect the Breeze passers whatsoever. They didn't have a break in their playoff game. They went 0 for 6. And in three matchups last season, they had 5 total breaks. That's just not going to win you any games against DC. And I think that unless they get Babbitt in some kind of role where he can affect some defense or some offensive possessions for the Breeze, it's going to be a similar story, because we saw it against Philly. When you don't get any kind of defensive pressure, and even in the last three quarters against Salt Lake, like, this Breeze team over the last several quarters has just been back at their normal stride. I think it took them a little bit to get over some of the tweaks that head coach Lauren Boyle made to the system that Daryl Stanley had been running for years, but this looks like the Breeze. It looks like Andrew Roy, Gus Norbaum, Johnny Malk setting up the table, and Tyler Monroe, Elliot Bonet, and the rest of the downfield talent just kind of knocking it down. Like, they're as good of a throw and catch team, which I know is a really simple way of putting it, but the Breeze are the best throw and catch team I think we have in this league. Like, they just make offense look downright easy. And Boston has, you know, the Jeff Babbitt edition. They've got these really explosive rookie defenders in Jonastang Osborne and Rowan Dunkerley, the last of which is an 18-year-old who made his pro debut this past weekend. Some big layout blocks. Like, there is some potential to disrupt. DC's so dang disciplined, man. Like, they're getting back their defensive captain and David Bloodgood. Rowan is back in the lineup this week. It'll be interesting to see where he lines up. Thought the DC offense looked a little bit more polished almost, but with addition through subtraction, as I kind of hinted at last week. As much as Boston has improved in their lineup, I struggle to see how they actually win in X's and O's against a very, very good DC team.
Yeah, I mean, I get where you're coming from. I think the addition of Ben Katz helps, right? Like, just another savvy defender.
Ben Katz, I'm sorry. That is a tragic omission by me. I can't continue.
Yeah, I think that helps, right? That's definitely going to add something.
Absolutely.
I think Boston needs to pick their spots, though, and, like, maybe try to find some opportunities where if they have, say, a really easy offensive point, maybe putting, you know, having Babbitt go back out for defense. I've seen him on some deep points occasionally for Boston. Of course, at the end of quarters, he's out there. But I think this is going to be one of those games where you have to kind of really maximize what you can get out of your star players. So if that means Babbitt plays all the O points and also finds his way into 5 or 6 D points, then that's what you got to do. Maybe you pick your spots, certain points in the game. Maybe you go in with the plan of trying not to put him on defense, but kind of see how things go, and maybe you have an audible ready to call. I don't know what the answer is, honestly. I do think there's also something to the fact that their offense should be able to find a little bit more success than they did in games against Boston last year, meaning that with that offensive success, it does take a little bit of the pressure off of your defense and puts a little bit more pressure on the DC offense. You know, I felt like in most of their matchups last year, DC was, as you mentioned, just a little too comfortable. And it kind of felt like they were just comfortable throughout the game on both sides of the disc. They were getting breaks when they needed to get breaks. They were converting on offense at a super high rate. So it didn't really feel like they ever had any pressure on them. I don't think that'll be quite the case in this game, as I expect Boston to just be better offensively and kind of keep up with DC for the most part. Where Boston could get into trouble, and I saw this in week 1, and, you know, they just weren't playing the caliber of team, I think, to really test them in week 2. But in week 1, there was some stagnation that happened on offense occasionally where they were just trying to cram it straight up the sideline. And they would get it on the sideline maybe 20 yards outside their end zone. And then they would work it up that last 60 yards, never getting anywhere near back to the middle of the field. And that is something I think they're going to have to make sure they don't do in this game. If they just try to cram it up the sideline the whole time, they're going to run into issues. And that's actually what we saw in the Montreal game, where late in the game, Montreal made some defensive adjustments, it looked like, or maybe just recognized that they were trying to cram it up the sideline the whole time. And then Boston wasn't really able to do that in the fourth quarter when when Montreal kind of stampeded back and got to within a goal again. So have they worked some of those kinks out with some more time with some of these new players? That's something that I think I'm going to keep my eye on as on the offensive side of this, where maybe we aren't as worried. I do have some concerns.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I just, Boston, for, again, all of their additions, I think just doesn't match up super well against DC and what they like to run. I think two players that I really want to talk about on both teams really quickly for Boston, gonna circle Ben Katz. I feel awful about not mentioning him as far as the kind of defensive presence he brings. He had a lesser performance this past weekend, but I think against the Breeze, he's really going to figure into how they want to slow down DC's handler unit. And then also Tyler Chan for Boston. I think he's just the kind of X factor where if he gets going or if he finds a matchup that he likes, he can really start to torture your defenses with his speed. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side for DC, Cole Jurek. He's playing more of a defensive role this year, but he's starting to get, I think, his beast mode sort of playmaking chops back. I think he's sort of been conditioned in the DC system the past season and a half to just be a precision thrower. And in the first two games for the Breeze, he looks a little bit more like the beef we know from his Minnesota days. Really excited for that development. And then also Tyler Monroe, man. I mean, without Christian Boxley in this offense, without Ben Ort, I think two of the more pronounced playmakers downfield for DC last season, Monroe just continues to be one of the most stabilizing players on any offense in the league. He just doesn't make mistakes. He takes every single matchup. I think I talked about this before in this show. Just as far as somebody that I trust in one-on-one situations, I don't know that there's like 15 players on offense I trust more than Tyler Monroe to like win a situation, to get the disc and make the right throw. He's just kind of always in the right space, fights for his possessions. Just love that dude. So that'll be the big Boston at DC matchup, but we've only talked about two of the 10 games so far. I wanted to kind of get into some potpourri topics. First off, I just wanted to ask you, you're going to be active now in week three. So yeah. How do you feel going into your first game of the season real quick?
Excited. I mean, obviously excited for the first game. You know, I've played, I don't know how many games at this point, 120 or 130 something, whatever. I still get nervous before every game. Doesn't matter who we're playing against. Doesn't matter what game of the season is. I get those like butterflies. I'm at the point now after waiting through the first 2 weeks, I feel like I've had butterflies in my stomach since the first Boston game against Montreal that like kind of kicked off our year. I feel like they've just been sitting in there stewing. So we are all very excited here in Indy to finally get started after watching so much Ultimate over the last couple weeks. So hopefully we get off to a good start and, you know, can build some positive momentum going into next week. As well, when we host Atlanta, which I know will be a game I think a lot of people have their eyes on. So
I just hope Detroit stays within like 15 of you guys. That's my hope for your
I'm pleading the fifth. I just hope we win. I'm just going to leave it there.
So Boston travels to DC on Friday night, but that isn't their only matchup of week three. They also got to go face Philly coming off of a real Donnybrooking at the hands of DC in week two. Obviously, this is going to be a big game for Philly to not fall into an 0-2 hole in a very contentious-looking East Division, but it's also going to be pretty crucial based on their result on Friday for Boston, too, right? I mean, this is a team right now 2-0, but they have a real possibility of going 2-2. I think that they match up well with Philly, and especially given how the Phoenix looked in their first game, I'm a little worried for them going against a team as physical as the Glory and as prone to kind of, I think, getting combo multipliers. To your point about that Montreal matchup for Boston and where they struggled, I think sometimes they're not used to playing just disciplined, boring games at times. And so when the highlights are coming or they're not getting like an Orion Cable dunk or something, they just get a little lulled. And I felt like that's what happened against Montreal. And so I worry that that could similarly happen against a Philly team that's going to be desperate in this game at home. I mean, not only would they maybe be 0-2 on the season, they'd be 0-2 at home. And this Philly team hasn't historically been great on the road. So big matchup there. Also elsewhere and in the Central Division, Madison making their 2024 debut at Pittsburgh. Be the two-year debut for Kai Marcus, who missed all of 2023. For Madison, he set a single game franchise record for most throwing yards in the last start he made for the Radicals. So they're really excited about plugging him into offense, getting him touches with this new Frisbee and kind of being a lot more explosive than I think we've seen the Radicals for the past several years. But I will say to that, I've heard this line before from Madison's leadership, and I'll wait to see it. I'll wait to see the offensive adjustments that suddenly break through and finally get them back on track like they were in 2018.
The way you're talking about Madison is the way that I feel about Philly going into this Boston game. It's just like, I keep hearing it. I need to see something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they are both teams that have struggled to finish above 6-6 for the past several seasons. So it's pretty much the waterline or marker for their achievements, right?
Yeah.
And on the flip side, Pittsburgh 0-1, they're looking for, I think, just kind of any defensive identity after not registering a break against Minnesota in their first matchup. I think the Radicals have traditionally been, the past couple of seasons, a team in which you can find some defensive break opportunities, but Pittsburgh looked really tentative on their counterattacking possessions. Hopefully they can find some more stability there. Austin is at Dallas, coming off of their 11-goal win against Houston. It figures to be another pretty crushing blow for the soul on the road against their interstate rivals, the Legion. We've got the first Canadian matchup head-to-head of 2024 as Montreal faces off at Toronto. This will be a big game for both teams as Montreal is 0-2, Toronto 0-1. And historically, who's ever kind of owned the intercontinental, or I should say inter-Canadian battle, has been a little bit more playoff viable, whereas the one who doesn't fare well in these head-to-heads between Montreal and Toronto is kind of the cellar dweller of the East. So be interesting to see where the arrows point for each of these teams. Also back in the Central, I'm kind of jumping around here. Minnesota at Chicago, big, big game at the top of the Central Division standings and playoff potential there. I already see you nodding. I'm sure you're going to have your eyeballs all over that matchup.
Yep.
Weiss will be making. I'll get your thoughts in just a second. Just go run through it and then we can come back to it. You can absolutely jump in wherever you want. Jeff Weiss will be making his 2024 debut for the Union, and most notably for Minnesota, without two of their defensive starters, including all-defense member Dylan DeClercq, as well as Brett Bergmeier. Maybe they're 1-2 as far as X-factors on the counterattack. These two have been so vital to that quick strike, almost head-spinning quality that Minnesota's defense has had when they get break opportunities. They will be absent in this matchup, and that's going to be important again when Chicago's going to be featuring all of these kind of trees on offense with Weiss, John Lithgow, Jack Shanahan. Joe White's still not in the lineup yet. That'll be really interesting to see for the Union. But this is a big game for both teams. This has always kind of been a tone setter for each of their seasons. Minnesota owned the matchups last year. Chicago did the couple of seasons prior. We'll see who gets the rubber match in 2024. And then finally, I wanted to mention for your consideration, Cam, Oakland at Seattle. We talked about this going into the pre-planning for this episode. Seattle with a chance of starting the season 3-1 and possibly issuing a second loss to Oakland, in which case both Oakland and LA after week three would have two losses, Seattle with only one. So just immediately confirming this sort of melee out west that we had predicted going into the season, that the Cascades were going to be this wild card team potentially punching up. Where do you want to start with all of that stuff I just threw at you?
Let's start with Minnesota Chicago. I think out of the remaining matchups, that one's the most intriguing. I should say there's two. That's one of the two that are like the most intriguing of the remaining matchups. This one intriguing for a number of reasons. Like you said, the absences that Minnesota has, Dylan DeClercq. I think you could make an argument that Dylan DeClercq is the biggest absence that maybe they could have on their roster. I think he's just such an impactful player. He is the central piece to their counterattack because not only is he the one who's often getting these blocks, he is 100% the target they're looking for on the counterattack. They love to score, as I always put it. Minnesota wants to break you in three throws or less. And it feels like 9 times out of 10, that throw that's going to the end zone is to Dylan DeClercq. He outscores a lot of offensive players throughout the year with how many goals he gets all on the defensive side of the disc. And as you mentioned, Brett Burgmeier, I think, is also a huge loss for them, because those are probably two of their, arguably their two top guys in coverage downfield. So to be missing.
Well, can I just add?
Yeah.
To DeClercq's credit, his ability to muck up the middle of the field, to be such a predator in that mid space, mm-hmm. that second tier that we talk about, kind of able to, again, what we often refer to as disconnect the backfield from downfield. That's the DeClercq specialty, man. Yep. He's such a Wolverine in that space. And I feel like, especially against a Chicago team that's still looking to establish an offensive identity, given where they finished in 2023 and given their new additions now, this is going to be the area in which I felt like Minnesota could attack Chicago, because they're going to be able to look downfield and get these continuation looks. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what Weiss, Shanahan, and Lithiau all excel at. But where Minnesota can maybe flatten the Union attack is making them swing, making them do more short to mid-range passes. And without DeClercq and Burgmeier, too, he's terrific in that space as a coverage player, too. I'm a little concerned, because then I think you're really going to see Chicago try to play a really vertical game and get their height downfield and make them play kind of roulette with where Minnesota lines up Matt Rader. It figures that he's going to draw the Jeff Weiss matchup, but then you wonder who takes John Lithiau, who handles Jack Shanahan as a continuation thrower. There's a lot of problems that Minnesota's defense is going to have to solve without two of their starters.
Well, and I think I still favor Minnesota in this game, just because they do have such a system-wide approach and just such an understanding of how they want to play defense and how they want to disconnect the backfield from downfield, and they're so good at it. And we saw that Chicago's biggest problem last year was the handler space. The handler space was a huge problem for them. They still don't have Henry Goldenberg this week. So essentially they're kind of running it back with what they had last year, which proved to be pretty ineffective. So yeah, they've got these big targets downfield. They have Lithiau and Weiss. They're going to be adding to the equation. But can they get the disc there? And once they get it there, what happens if things get slowed down? Are they going to be able to slow march up the field? Because one thing Minnesota is pretty good at is not only not letting you get the disc upfield cleanly, but then when you do, they're pretty good about not allowing any of the big throws to get off, whether they throw a quick double team or they have people sitting in throwing lanes or they have somebody deep over the top. It seems like they always have some kind of solve for making sure you don't get clean deep looks. And I feel like that's where the Chicago offense would have its most success. So I feel like it's going to be almost like strength against strength, like upfield guys like Jeff Weiss and Lithiau and Jack Shanahan can definitely put the disc down for long continuation passes. And Minnesota's really good at stopping that. So something's going to have to give here. And I definitely favor the Minnesota defense in that, just because they're more practiced at it. This is going to be the first game for Weiss and Lithiau back with the Union and fitting in and figuring out how it's going to look. And let's be real, they didn't really get any great offensive reps last week. They spent 95% of that game on defense. So we didn't, like, I hesitate to even say they got a warm-up game in, because it was such a sloppy game. Detroit had 40-something turnovers. I mean, they didn't really get to test out this new O-line and see what it was going to look like. So I favor Minnesota. I do think it's a game to definitely watch, as we expect that these are two of the three teams we would think will be in the playoffs out of the Central this year.
Point in Minnesota's favor. Yeah, that team help defense deep, I think, is the league best right now, especially with New York not quite looking like themselves. The wind chill, to your point, and their system and their understanding of coverage is elite. I mean, this is why they are perennially within the top two in takeaways in this league. And I think that, to your point, that Chicago might struggle against such a disciplined defense. On the flip side, I think Weiss is one of those players who, if he's active, he's going to be a problem. And specifically against Minnesota, he was dominant in 2022. I know he missed all of last year, but he was just a matchup nightmare for a wind chill team that usually doesn't struggle in that capacity. To your points, like, they're very good at identifying where strength is in an offense and just complicating it. I think there's some of the best defenders as far as crowding or overcrowding a space. It just always feels like it's 3 versus 2, or they have some kind of numbers advantage almost wherever the disc is. It feels almost 8-on-7 at times with the way that they can kind of gang tackle, so to speak.
There's one more game I really want to talk about, which is Oakland Seattle. You mentioned it. Seattle has the opportunity to potentially be 3-1, which, you know, given where they've been over the last couple of seasons, right, to be 3-1 after 4 games, like, what a turnaround. Oakland does have a game the night before in Portland, so they won't be coming in completely fresh. But somebody has popped up on the Oakland roster who we weren't quite sure was going to be, and that's Keenan Lawrence. Saw Keenan Lawrence is listed as active going into this game. There was some question about whether he would be playing at all this season. And here we are, just a few games into Oakland season, and it looks like he will be making an appearance. So that is huge for Oakland. You could definitely make an argument for him being their most important or impactful player last year, maybe along with Mack Hecht. They are going to be without Raekwon Adkins and without Walter Frankenberg. They are getting Dexter Clyburn in this game, though, who hasn't played yet in 2024. In Seattle,
Jace Brunner is.
Oh.
I was going to add Jace Brunner as well.
Yes. And Seattle's going to be without Khalif El-Salam, who obviously a great player for them, and you would figure to have a big impact. Maybe that blow can be a little softened by the fact that Oakland is going to be missing some people and on their second day of a 2-game road trip. But they already got a win in Oakland last week, going up 2-0 in this series against a team that we think, if there is going to be some teams competing in that third spot, Oakland was certainly one of them. Going down 2-0 to Seattle and going to 1-2 on the season would be tough to come back from. They would need a lot of help moving forward. So we're looking at a game that could be just, you know, 3 weeks into the season, could maybe already be setting things in motion for the playoff picture, like right now. We could look back on this game and be like, this is where Seattle took control. Or this could be, on the opposite side, the galvanizing point for Oakland to get back into this playoff picture and make their bid for that third spot.
Well, and just like, if Seattle gets to 3 wins this early in the season, they'll be 3-1 after this week if they win against Oakland. They just have 2 more games combined against Colorado and Salt Lake, 1 apiece. They have one of the easiest schedules in the entire division going forward. It's not entirely out of the question that they could be 9-3 if they pick up this win against the Spiders. Because again, they have Nitro twice, still 3 times, excuse me. They've got a San Diego game, and they've got 2 games against LA. LA is going to be a beast. They looked real slow in their start in the first quarter against the Shred this past weekend, but they won the back 3 quarters, and I think that they're going to be a team much like last year, someone that picks up momentum as they get into the heart of the season. So those matchups will be to watch, but Seattle looks like they can hang with LA, if not sweep that season series as well. So yeah, a win this weekend, especially without Khalif, would be monumental for Seattle, and I kind of think that the Cascades have the sort of gumption to go get one in spite of their sort of captain not being there. I think that this will be a big, we want to go get one for him kind of performance from the Skates. And they just look, man, they look feisty as hell. I think Colorado was real surprised at how long and consistently that Cascades team kept punching at them on both lines. Like, Colorado was making plays and Cascades kept hanging around. So Oakland's going to have their hands full in the second game of a back-to-back. Again, you can check out all 10 games this weekend on WatchUFA TV. There is not a Super Series game this weekend or next. You'll have to wait until week 5 for the return of our free YouTube broadcast. But until then, again, you can watch all the games live on WatchUFA TV. We will be tuning in alongside you again, in particular for this weekend's Game of the Week matchup as Atlanta travels to Carolina on Saturday night. That'll do it here and now for this preview episode of Swing Pass. We will be back with you at the end of week 3 to recap it all. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye now.